Good evening, and welcome to Night of Conversation, a prevention podcast. My name is Allison Barden, and I am the coordinator of the Madison-Chatham Coalition. Along with the Madison Area YMCA, we are pleased to present this evening's podcast. In our fourth year of participating in this national initiative, the Madison Area YMCA and Madison-Chatham Coalition have created this podcast in an effort to learn effective ways to open the lines of communication between parents and teens about substance use and mental health. These can be difficult topics to address with teens, but thanks to the support of our panel of local experts, we hope that you will listen and start a conversation of your own. We are honored to have the following panelists participate in tonight's podcast: Dr. Gary Cohn, pediatric pulmonologist of Summit Medical Group; Christine McIntyre and Mike Eklund, clinicians with Project Community Pride of the Madison Area YMCA; Kelly Kaczynski, community liaison; and John Serrato, adolescent clinician, both with high focus centers; Vanessa Morgenthaler, student assistance counselor at Madison High School; and three members of the Madison-Chatham Coalition Teen Task Force. Please stay tuned after the podcast is over for more information about the Madison Area YMCA and Madison-Chatham Coalition, as well as the resources discussed tonight. So we're pleased to welcome Dr. Gary Cohn, pediatric pulmonologist with Summit Medical Group. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Cohn. If you could just start by sharing a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Thank you for having me. So I'm a pediatric pulmonologist at Summit Medical Group, and I see primarily children with lung difficulties, asthma, breathing difficulties, and with recent events, seeing a lot of children with concerns about injury to vaping.
So what is eVally? We've heard a lot about this in the news lately. What is it?
So eVally is an acronym that came out from the CDC, which stands for e-cigarette or vaping associated lung injury, and is related to the rash of acute lung injury that we started to see this summer, where people were being hospitalized for acute lung injury, respiratory failure, and death.
What are we seeing in e-cigarettes, in cartridges? What are the chemical compounds that are found?
That's an excellent question, because we're not quite sure for all of the cartridges. Obviously, any of the commercial products that are being promoted by the companies are primarily nicotine products dissolved in solutions that may or may not be good for you. And then there is what we sort of refer to as the black market cartridges, which are THC, cannabinoid, and whatever the street people want to put in those cartridges. So that is probably our biggest concern, is that people really have absolutely no idea what they're vaping and inhaling into their lungs.
So is it safe to say that what's in cartridges is not just flavoring or not just vapor? There's other things that
right.
are included.
Yeah, so obviously nicotine's in it, the THC, the cannabinoid, and whatever this is dissolved in, but we don't know what it is. You know, what I try to tell all my patients, because they want to ask, is it safe, is let's face it. Your lungs like air, the same way fish like pure water. So I don't care if you're vaping THC, cannabinoid. A decade ago, everybody was going to hookah bars, smoking dandelions, and they thought that was safe. But it's still foreign material going down into the lung, creating injury that you don't need to do.
Mm-hmm. And is there a way to reverse the effects of vaping on the lungs?
I think that it's too early in the process to know what kind of injury and damage is occurring. We know that steroids have been used in eVally for people that have significant lung injury, and they're seeing benefit from it. And that may protect them from the acute process, but we still don't know what the long-term effects of that vaping products and that disease process. And I think that the story will probably play out pretty similar to cigarettes, where 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now, we're going to see the effects of long-term injury on the lungs for people that partook in this on a pretty consistent basis.
So it sounds like there's just a lot of question marks across the board with vaping. So this next question is probably going to be difficult to answer as well. But is vaping better or worse than cigarettes? Is there a clear-cut answer to that?
I alluded to earlier, nothing foreign down in the lungs is good for you. I know that there's lots of people saying that vaping is safer than cigarettes. I think it's just swapping one evil for another, and it's a question of which one's going to get you first.
Do you have to vape every day
to become addicted to it?
I think that's unclear as to what you're vaping. So we know nicotine is an addictive agent. So obviously, the more exposure you have to the nicotine, the higher likelihood that you're going to become addicted. I think every person has their own threshold as to how much they have to be doing until they become addicted and have a harder time getting off those products. Most of the kids that I have seen in my practice, though, have really been more recreational vaping. Vast majority are doing it one or two times on the weekends at parties and not consistently doing it during the week. So I think those children or students are probably easier to stop if they want to. The few that I've had that are smoking multiple pods in the course of a day, every day of the week, are going to struggle more with the possible addiction if it's a nicotine product.
Okay, so talking about what you're seeing currently with your patients, is that something that is prevalent right now? Are you seeing vaping?
So my asthma patients all claim not to be vaping, which is good because they associate already having a bad lung problem. Mm-hmm. But I am seeing a lot of students showing up to be evaluated for possible injury to their lungs because they know they've been vaping and after watching what's happening in the media are concerned. And the vast majority of them have not shown any obvious lung injury, but we're not looking at their lungs from a microscopic level. We're looking at it as a gross function. Do they move as much air as they're supposed to? And I think that if there's long-term injury, it's not going to be on that gross level. It's going to be on that microscopic level 10, 15, 20 years down the road of whether or not these, you know, compounds are precancerous for that risk. Are they going to destroy lung tissue at a faster rate so they have less lung function when they're older? You know, what I try to explain to the students is that it's very common for kids to get away with a lot of stupid behaviors at a young age because their body's young and there's a lot of reserve. Mm-hmm. What they don't understand is you pay on the tail end. And everybody loses lung function over the course of their life. So if you knock off at 30% at 16, 17, you may not notice it unless you're an elite athlete or doing high-end exercise, but you may be missing that 30% when you're 60 or 70 years of age. And as we all know, adolescents have a hard time looking that far down the road.
So it sounds like the patients are coming in sort of as a preventative measure. If they've been vaping, they just want to make sure that their lungs are clear, that they're okay. And the hope would be that they stop if they are using, if they are vaping, that they're going to stop at that point once you tell them that, you know, you're not quite seeing the effects yet. Is there an age range that you're seeing with vaping? Is it mostly, I know you're a pediatric pulmonologist, is it mostly middle school students, high school students? Is it across the board?
So most of what I'm seeing are the high schoolers that are worried about it. But I think, A, they're old enough to see the media and understand it, so they put it together. I ask all my 12-year-olds and up about vaping, anybody that's in middle school, at the visits. Very few of them are admitting to personally doing it, but they all seem to know people that are. We know that the data is somewhere between 11 and 30% of middle school and high school have at least tried it. So it falls into that range probably in what I'm seeing in the office.
And a lot of what we hear now with the work that the coalition is doing, we work with schools, we work with parents, we work with community members, especially with the student assistance counselors at the middle school and high school level. We hear that students want to stop now. They've been vaping for a period of time, maybe for a year, maybe for less than that, and they're noticing the effects on their lungs and they want to stop. What's your advice to somebody who has identified that they want to quit?
Most of them truly are most likely not truly addicted. So it's just a matter of going that cold turkey, having the willpower to do it, and just stopping. The ones that are truly addicted, the ones that are using the nicotine products on a high level, may need assistance of care providers with nicotine alternatives, sort of patches, counseling. You know, I think the kids that are in that category may have other issues going on besides just the use of nicotine. Those are the kids that tend to have other high-risk behaviors, anxiety, other things that are going on in their life that led them to that point. The other part that has always been big in this age group is peer pressure, right? I had one kid the other day said he wants to stop, but all his friends do it, his girlfriend does it, And I said, it's okay to hang out with them and not do it. The question that comes up is a lot about the secondhand vaping. And again, we don't know what the effects are. The vaping cloud may not be as large as traditional cigarettes, but again, if it's getting into the lungs, not as good. But I said, no, you stand back. You don't have to participate. And I tell them that we have things that show that students can do this, right? I don't want to pick on my age, but when I was younger, drinking and driving was common amongst adolescents. It's not as common because we've educated these kids. They've understood the concept of being a designated driver. So why not be a designated non-vapor for the party? Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of conversations that I think you could have with the kids and talk about that it's okay. You don't have to do everything that the kid next to you does.
So that leads perfectly into our last question. And just talking about Night of Conversation, and the main idea behind the initiative is for parents and teens to be able to talk about these things, substance use, mental health, openly, and to just start this conversation. So my last question for you, in your opinion, how can a family start the conversation around vaping at home?
I'm a open door policy type of guy. I just come straight out and ask them. And the truth is, some kids will lie to their parents about it. Some will be open. A lot of it depends on your initial parenting style. You know, I sort of have the philosophy that I tell my kids that honesty is the best approach, and that if you're honest with us as parents, that the repercussions are going to be less if they tell us up front, and this is vaping or any other activities, than if we find out from other sources. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, as parents, our goal is to protect our children. And part of this is just education. And I think to the parents, you got to say, hey, even if you ask the kids and deny it, what I do in my office with the kids is say, hey, without you telling me the truth or not, I want you to have the take-home message, which is vaping is not safe. So if you're doing it, stop. If you're thinking about it, don't. Find another activity.
That's a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Dr. Cohn, for your help today and for all the information that you shared. It's been very valuable. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We're pleased to welcome Mike Eklund, licensed counselor, and Christine McIntyre, licensed clinical social worker, both with Project Community Pride of the Madison Area YMCA. Thank you both so much for being here. Christine, if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about Project Community Pride.
Oh, sure. Project Community Pride is a youth counseling and support program for children, teens, and their families. These families live in Madison, Chatham, and Florham Park. Our program offers individual counseling, family counseling. We also run groups and provide parent support. These services are at no cost to the families because we're funded by the three school districts, Madison, Chatham, and Florham Park, and the police departments, Madison, Chatham Borough, and Florham Park. Our program has a staff of LCSWs, which is licensed clinical social workers, and licensed therapists. We can see families at our office, and also we see families at the schools.
So you actually go into the schools and see children and teens in their school setting?
Yes, that's actually a very unique component to our program. We do go into the schools. We have great relationships with the guidance departments, and we work out scheduling with the students, teachers, and ourselves.
And you mentioned before groups. What types of groups do you run at the schools?
We have various groups. Some of them are like freshmen in high school adjusting to being in high school, middle school groups, middle school kind of issues with peers, getting along. Sometimes there are kids that are new to our school and to our area, so we'll have a group for that. We really try to meet the needs of the community, so depending on what kind of issues are coming up, we can develop a group.
So Christine, of the teens that you're currently seeing at Project Community Pride, what are the most common reasons that they're coming in? What are the most common issues that you're seeing amongst teens?
I think some of the common issues would be family stress, academic pressures, issues with peers, either falling out of a peer group or feeling like that they're not really having kind of the peer connections that they would like, just teen adjustment issues, and some of the bigger ones would be anxiety and depression.
So of the teens that you see at Project Community Pride that are using drugs and alcohol, why do you think that they start in the first place?
Well, I think there's some various reasons. Some would be experimentation, that they're just at a party and there's exposure to drugs and alcohol. And some of the more concerning ones would be that they're medicating anxiety and depression with drugs and alcohol.
What advice would you have for parents that have never had this conversation about drugs and alcohol with their teens? How can they get this conversation started for the first time?
So I think it's not necessarily just one conversation. I think it's ongoing conversations. We need to bring up drugs and alcohol as a topic at the dinner table, in the car, questions maybe about drugs and alcohol that have nothing to do with them per se, but just about in the news or about something you heard about in town, something that happened, or if you see something going on, you mention it. I think that it needs to be something that the kids feel like they can bring up, they can share and have different opinions, and that there'll be kind of like this open dialogue between you and your child.
So really easing into the conversation and making it something that is familiar to them and that they can expect that their parents are going to start asking them questions like this so that they're prepared for it.
Correct.
Okay.
And I just want to say one thing. I think just having like a safe place for them where you can have a difference of opinion with your child so they think that they can bring up topics, because what the parents may be wanting to get across to their children, sometimes they might have a different opinion. So you have to allow space for that, and then you just repeat kind of what your value is as a family. And I think that that's kind of one way to kind of get this topic of drugs and alcohol going with your child.
So it sounds like you're saying being consistent is very important also. Consistency, as we know for teens and for anyone really, is very important when it comes to values and what's expected of them.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, Mike, so if a teenager tunes me out when I'm trying to have this conversation about substance use with them, what do I do now?
Well, from what I've experienced with the teens that I've worked with is that, you know, very often if they don't want to have a conversation with their parent, it tends to be because they feel like their parent can't relate to what they're going through at the time. Sometimes they feel like there was a disconnect or maybe communication had broken down, that at some point, you know, as they became a teen, either the parent lost touch with what was going on with them, or actually they might have lost touch with what was going on with the parent as well. So that leaves you with the question, what to do about it. So when I'm working with a parent and their teen and they're trying to open up a discussion, it could be specifically about substance abuse or it could be about other things as well. I try to start a dialogue where the one generation starts to relate to the other generation. And I'll actually take a step back and help explain the various generational values to, you know, from the parent to the teen and from the teen to the parent, so that they can remember that they're both doing the best job that they possibly can. And really, they just need to rebuild that trust so that they can have open communication.
Okay, Mike, so we've talked about how parents and teens can begin to open the lines of communication and relate to one another. Mm-hmm. But what happens when, after we've had that initial conversation, my teen wants to know about the ways that I experimented when I was a teenager, when I was their age, and they want to know if I experimented with any drugs or with alcohol? How do I answer that question without maybe giving too much information?
Sure. Well, there's definitely limits to how far you should go when you're explaining your own history, because the bottom line is you're not your child's friend, you're their parent. And there are limits. They don't need to view you as being their friend. So it's now that we've opened up communication and we've kind of laid the groundwork for mutual understanding. With that being said, there's a power differential between parents and children. So you don't need to be 100% transparent, because the truth is every single person, as they were developing, becoming an adult, made mistakes and stumbled along the way. Some made bigger mistakes than others. Your child doesn't need to know every graphic detail about some of your own stumble. Everybody has different value systems, and some value transparency more than others. In that regard, they can be more open with their children, but bearing in mind that they're their child's parent.
Christine, is there anything you would want to add there?
But I think really what's the goal of sharing? I think you have to ask yourself that. Like, what's the goal of me wanting my kids to know kind of what I was doing when I was a teenager? And, you know, if that answer of what the goal was makes sense, you know, I think that can guide you.
So it sounds like preparation is definitely key also. Being prepared that your teen might ask you this question and sort of knowing how you would answer it if it does come up.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So shifting gears a little bit, we've talked about substance use. The other thing that you mentioned you're seeing a lot of clients for right now is stress and anxiety. So with all of the stress and anxiety that teens face. And we know athletics and social media and homework and college acceptances. How, in your opinion, can parents help children cope with all of these different stressors that they face today?
Well, I think that, again, you know, we talked about having an open kind of discussions and dialogue with your kids as a check-in to kind of see how are you doing? How, you know, is your kid sleeping well? Do they come home and do they seem like they're happy? Is it easy for them to wake up and go to school? Kind of find out what's going on. What are their grades like? Sometimes the grades are a big indication of how things are going with kids. Are they going out and doing activities with kids? Are they going out to the mall? Are they participating in clubs and sports? I think that's something that you know, as long as your kid is being more active in the community, that's kind of a good sign that things might be okay. If they are coming in with anxiety, it's, you know, our program offers counseling like we had discussed, but also there are things about helping kids kind of to relax, ways to kind of take a break if they're stressed out, finding out kind of what the core of stressing, what's stressing out the child is also a good starting point. Mm-hmm. Is it academics? Is it that they're falling out of their peer group? You know, I think did they break up with the boyfriend or girlfriend recently? I think that's something that you'd want to find out to get them the help they need.
So getting down to the root of the problem. Okay, Mike, my last question is for you. I've heard a lot in the past, I'd say, I don't know, year, about mindfulness, this mindfulness movement. And I feel like I see it everywhere in social media, in the news. Oprah talks about it all the time. What is mindfulness? And is it something that I should be practicing? Is it something that my child should be practicing? Does it mean different things for the two of us?
Yeah, you make a really good point, Allison, which is that this is a buzzword, and it has been for the last few years. So, you know, without giving an overly technical answer, I think that mindfulness is a part of our awareness and our consciousness. So I like to kind of jokingly use the phrase motion in the ocean. That's like everything that we're thinking about, we're feeling during the course of the day. It's like our internal weather. But mindfulness is the part of our mind that kind of remains still. You know, there's almost, for me, it's almost like an Eastern notion. It's just like the stillness in our brains, in our minds, that kind of allows us to be aware of everything that's going on. And that's the part that we try to develop, whether it's through meditation or some other type of activity, anything that develops a sense of quiet and stillness in the mind. Again, meditation probably be being the best example, but there are other ways to do that as well. Any kind of activity that can develop what we call a sense of flow, that's where you kind of just get outside your own mind.
That's a perfect place to stop. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Christine, for participating in this podcast. We really appreciate the advice that you've given to parents tonight.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thanks so much.